Hello everyone, welcome to the second season of the series of podcasts with IEEE Electron Devices Society Luminaries. As the world's largest professional organization, IEEE plays a significant role to enhance the quality of our life. Electron Devices Society, or EDS, encompasses activities involving electron devices, the main enabler for today's digital world. I'm Muhammad Mustafa Hussain, a professor of Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering of Purdue University. I play a variety of roles in different capacities within the Electron Devices Society of IEEE. In this series of podcasts, we will be interviewing those EDS members who have made remarkable impacts in our society through their innovations and dedication. Our guest is someone who has been dubbed as the legend to bring unprecedented positive transformations to world-renowned Indian Institute of Technology campuses. We are speaking with past director of IIT, Professor V. Ram Gopal Rao. Professor V. Ram Gopal Rao is currently a professor in electrical engineering and the immediate past director of IIT Delhi. Before joining IIT Delhi as the director in April 2016, Dr. Rao served as a P.K. Kelkar Chair Professor for Nanotechnology in the Department of Electrical Engineering and as the Chief Investigator for the Center of Excellence in Nanoelectronics Project at IIT Bombay. Dr. Rao has over 480 research publications in the area of nanoscale devices and nanoelectronics, and is an inventor on 49 patents and patent applications, which include 18 issued US patents. 13 of his patents have been licensed to industries for commercialization. Professor Rao is a co-founder of two deep technology startups at IIT Bombay, NanoSniff and SoilSense, which are developing products of relevance to the society. Dr. Rao is a fellow of IEEE, a fellow of the Indian National Academy of Engineering, the Indian Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Sciences, and the Indian National Science Academy. Professor Rao's research and leadership contributions have been recognized with over 30 awards and honors in the country and abroad. He is a recipient of 3 honorary doctorates. The recognitions Professor Rao received include the Shanti Swarup Bhatnagar Prize in Engineering Sciences, Infosys Prize, the IEEE EDS Education Award, Excellence in Research Awards from IIT Bombay, DAE and DRDO, Swarna Jayanti Fellowship Award from the Department of Science and Technology, IBM Faculty Award, Best Research Award from the Intel Asia Academic Forum, Techno Visionary Award from the Indian Semiconductor Association, J.C. Bose National Fellowship, among many others. Professor Rao was an editor for the IEEE Transactions on Electron Devices during 2003 to 2012 for the CMOS Devices and Technology area, and currently serves on the Editorial Advisory Board of ACS Nanoletters, a leading international journal in the area of nanotechnology. He is a distinguished lecturer, IEEE Electron Devices Society, and interacts closely with many semiconductor industries, both in India and abroad. Dr. Rao served as the chairman, IEEE AP/ED Bombay chapter, and as a vice chairman, IEEE Asia-Pacific Regions/Chapter Subcommittee for 2 terms. He was the first elected chairman for the India section, American Nano Society, during 2013 to 2015. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Professor Hussain. Thanks for connecting with me, and it's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. So first, thanks for taking the time and accepting our invitation. And I will start from the very beginning, and that is actually, you know, where are you from, and how was your childhood, your school life, you know, and any regret that you have that you could have done differently?
In fact, I come from the southern part of India, I come from a specific state called Telangana, and I was born in a very remote kind of a village, which is still pretty underdeveloped. And I studied in my local language, which is Telugu, until my 12th standard. So I had no exposure to English until I was 17 years of age. And if at all I spoke English, it was, you know, maybe for a few seconds here and there, but I never had any opportunity to converse with anyone in English for a longer period of time. And so that was the background I started with. But for all of us who were in that state, Telangana, there was a local, or there is still a local examination for getting admission into engineering. In India, as you might know, I think engineering and medicine, these are the two professions that everybody aspires to get into, because they are like, you know, passports to US. That was one reason. And secondly, you know, you get a job. I mean, you are guaranteed, or you are pretty sure you can find a decent job if you do engineering or medicine. So that's the reason why for many of us who come from a lower middle class kind of a background, when you are in a resource constrained kind of a place like India, where there are 1.3 billion people, and there is nothing, you know, which is available in abundance, you know, it's always the first task for any family, for any person, is to secure their future. So it all starts with that. There are no ambitions, there is no passion, nothing. You first want to secure your life, get a decent job, and then you worry about, you know, any other kind of a thing. So I also started the same way. So doing engineering was a very natural choice for me, because I knew that I would get a job with that. So I cleared the local examination, because I came from I studied in a Telugu medium, the local language, that was the only option available for me. And IITs, you know, in India, the most famous institutions are Indian Institutes of Technology, but those examinations are only held, at that time, they were held only in English. It was not available in any other language. So it was completely out of bounds for people like me. And now that exam is held still in English and Hindi, only two national languages, not in local languages. So, but at that time, I actually, you know, I'm talking of in 70s, that's when I went to school. And 82 is when I took admission into a local engineering college in Telangana. And but engineering is all in English in India. So for me, the biggest challenge was the transition from Telugu to English. And for somebody from a rural background without having any exposure to English, and suddenly now everybody is talking in English, everybody is speaking and in that language, and all lectures are in English. So that was a bit of a challenge for me. And it took me full 1 year. For example, when they say electron, you know, we don't call electron, you know, electron in our language. It was, you know, something else. So to me, to connect those words with the English words was a pretty big challenge. But I think a year down the line, I was able to cope up with that. And I then graduated with a BTech, the Bachelor's in Technology, as we call it. And so that, you know, was the first step, that having a engineering degree. And then I went to IIT Bombay for my master's. And that was a turning point in my life. For me, from a rural background, having studied in a local college, coming to IIT Bombay, which is one of the top institutions in India, you know, I think that opened up many opportunities for me. And after that, I went to Germany for my PhD. I did my doctor engineer degree. I obtained my doctor engineer degree from Munich. And then I went to UCLA, the University of California, Los Angeles. And after that, I came back and joined IIT Bombay as a faculty member, as an assistant professor. That was in 1998. So that is how my career started, from a very rural, humble kind of a background, and ended up becoming a faculty member in one of the India's topmost engineering institutions. And after that, I started working on multiple projects, and things worked out pretty well for me.
Thanks for sharing in such a candid manner. And I think, Makyon, the story that you told us, that will relate to many as an inspiring story. I had the opportunity to visit you on the 2nd of January 2018. I was visiting at that point the IITs. And you discussed a few things about your aspiration with IIT. And yesterday I was reading a news feature about you, because you just left IIT director position last week, that they described you as a legend, because the things that you have done for IIT during your tenure as a director, and we'll be hearing about that story. So I think that came from the fact that you started with so many challenges, but that relates to many, many others, but still that did not stop you. So you kept moving forward. And I think that makes this story is so relatable and so humane. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
My next question is, how was your college life? The fun stuff and so many different things.
I did not have the traditional, usual kind of a college fun, because I came from a very rural kind of a background. It was all, the struggle to fit in into an urban society. And people in my class were all from Hyderabad and, big cities, and who spoke English much better than I did. And I had a small, small friend circle, but most of it was, the people who depended on me for their education, for their studies. They were, they wanted me to explain to them concepts, because I was good in academics from the beginning. And so I had at least, a close knit of friends, and to whom I teach in my room. And so they were they also turned out to be my friends. And but otherwise, I also came from a very conservative kind of a family, a South Indian family. For me, in engineering, I think it remained mostly academic, the focus was to do well in academics and not enjoy life or anything like that. And it was not even anywhere on my mind. So it was okay. I mean, if I look back, I think the only incidents I remember as having fun were maybe the Holi. In India, there is a festival of colors. And on that day, everybody goes onto the streets and throws colors at each other. So for me, some of those memories were, celebrating Holi with friends. And so we looked forward to that. And otherwise, whenever you get a chance, you go back home and, that sort of a thing. So, but it was nice. There was nothing negative about it, but it was more academic oriented, my entire education, the BTech degree. And even in my master's also at IIT Bombay, the focus was academics, to do well in the class, that sort of a thing. And I don't think, and even the definition of enjoyment also is different for different people, probably. For me, enjoying was to sit with friends, chat, or go out, go for a movie. So those sort of things, of course, we all did. And so that way I had a good time. And I still have many close friends from that place. And I meet with them and we still celebrate. And I think it was nice also.
Yeah, well, that I went to Buet in Dhaka. And so that is considered as the top university in Bangladesh. And we also had, our friends who had the similar characteristics that you just described about yourself. And they're very, you know, that they were very reverent because they used to take all the notes and they knew about ins and outs of pretty much each of the courses. So just before the exam, right? So there was a the preparatory week. And everyone was just like, you know, in front of their college dormitory. So I think that was the biggest fun because the friends had to take a lot of like, you know, the good food. And so that like, it's kind of a benign bribery to them. But yeah, it all worked out eventually. So and very important question is that technically, you are a world-renowned authority on electron devices. So what really triggered your interest toward, you know, electronics?
Yeah, so the electronics part of it for me started when I joined IIT Bombay. My master's, M.Tech as we call it in India, master's in technology, was in microelectronics. And that is when I got an exposure to the microelectronics and electron devices. In fact, it was all because of the teachers, I would say. I did not know anything about electron devices, you know, before I joined IIT Bombay. But we had some great teachers there, like Professor Vasi, Professor Chandorkar, Professor Dinesh Sharma. I think some of them were excellent teachers. So they kindled that interest in me for electron devices. And I also found it very fascinating. And I started my electronics, the electron devices journey in trying to develop radiation hard electron devices for Indian Space Research Organization, the ISRO, as we call it, which is India's space agency. And for ISRO needed at that time radiation hard electron devices. And my master's project was the radiation hard MOS devices. And we developed the technology. We transferred it to a local foundry, a Government of India foundry. So that that is how I got that exposure. And after that, I joined for PhD because I got so excited with this area. I joined for PhD in Germany. And there I worked on the vertical MOSFETs. My PhD was in 97. So yeah, 1997. So at that time, the channel lengths were all in hundreds of nanometers. And so I worked on a 100 nanometer, sub 100 nanometer vertical MOSFET. And that was, you know, further into the electron devices. And therefore it all started with the teachers, with the project that I did. And then I got interested in that area. I pursued my PhD. And then I remained in that field. Now I still have many students working on electron devices. And but of late, since coming back to India, and since India doesn't have any semiconductor foundries, you know, my electron devices work was all with Intel, IBM, and these kind of companies, Infineon. So I did many projects for them, but it had no real takers in the country. And so I moved into sensors area because I thought sensors will be one thing which is of interest to the country. So I very consciously developed, expertise in micro fabricated sensors. That is, these are the things that I borrowed from the CMOS. And so using the similar kind of micro fabrication technologies, then I started fabricating micro sensors. And now these days, nano sensors. And these sensors have started applying to multiple domains which are of interest to the country, whether it is developing an explosive detector or developing diagnostic kits, you know, or developing sensors for agricultural area. So that area has become become pretty interesting for the country in terms of the technologies that are needed, whether it is farmers or security agencies or anyone else. So that way now I have developed interest in CMOS on one side and sensors on the other side. But now many of these are coming together in more than more kind of an area, you know, the integrating these sensors with the electronics. I think all of these are now in a way getting integrated. And so these are the two areas where I primarily focus on right now.
Great. While you were doing your PhD, do you have any specific memory that that kind of changed your, or that I would say that impacted your career in future? You know, that kind of story you would like to share?
Interesting question. You know, one of the things is for me, having spent 17 years in a rural kind of a background in a very remote area of the country, you know, everywhere it was a fitting in, you know, the everywhere it was getting adjusted to a new place. I thought I adjusted to Bombay life pretty well. And then I moved to Europe and the language was different. I did a 4-month course in German, because at that time there was a requirement that in Germany, you can write your thesis in English, but you have to defend it in German. So I had to pick up enough German to you know, defend my thesis. So that's how it was. And I could speak German at that time. Even now I can manage if I have to. And there in Germany, I went to a good group, Professor Eisele, we had a project sponsored by Siemens. At that time, Infineon was part of Siemens, or Infineon had not come out of Siemens. So Siemens was the company which was sponsoring those projects. So I had a fellowship for doing my PhD. And so we used MBE at that time. And the characterization, understanding the physics, it all became pretty exciting. And my first IEDM paper was my PhD work. And until that time in Germany, in my group, they were all physicists primarily. And Germany has a very strong tradition of doing, you know, good physics. So I went to a group which was also quite a bit into physics. They had no idea about devices. And they were always getting into, you know, the physics aspects of these devices, but never optimizing the device from a circuit point of view, from an application point of view. So that way I was the first engineer in that group. And so that opened up many opportunities for me. While they were focusing on the physics part of it, I was looking at the device part of it, you know, optimizing the device characteristics, you know, understanding the series resistance, what kind of a role a series resistance would play in the device performance for a vertical MOSFET. And that you know, was a good opportunity, because it brought in very complementary kind of skills together. And so that was my first paper in IEDM and in 97, I guess. So that was in, and then I attended IEDM in 98 while I was in UCLA. So it was all pretty exciting, and that opened up opportunities for connecting with the rest of the world, the other researchers. So attending IEDM was a good experience, and I have been attending IEDMs, you know, pretty regularly, because that in a way connected me to all the researchers in this area. So it opened up multiple opportunities for a collaboration. So now I collaborate with many groups. And I think, you know, now things have been pretty good, but that's how it all started. For somebody from a remote part of the country to, you know, getting connected with the world at the world level, I think it all happened because of attending conferences and, you know, that sort of a thing. And I also tell my students, you know, I also send my students to attend these conferences, even if they don't have a paper, because I said, no, just go there, talk to people, explain your work to them, get their feedback. I think that those networks are pretty important, and you know, that's what we need to, you know, keep developing as we progress in life. So just writing journal papers is not always sufficient. It's always important to attend conferences.
So. No, you are absolutely right. Like, you know, these are a huge networking opportunity. You can always expand. One can always expand his or her horizon, and more importantly, today, that an academic, it is no more only a job of writing papers, right? Like, you know, it is about making a difference, making impacts. And it has to be with many different things. Every single student that we advise, right? Like, you know, so that's our right away, like, you know, an outcome. And obviously, like, you know, because it shapes up their career, their personal life, and many different things. And obviously, as a team, what we are doing for our society. Journal papers and, like, you know, all those are some numerical metrics, and obviously they have their own values. But today it's much more pervasive than, you know, the traditional way of thinking and so on and so forth. One interesting question I would like to ask you, that you have done so much in your career and like, you know, for the organizations, for your country. So when you look back, if you were given the opportunity again, would you have chosen electron devices or something else in engineering or even engineering?
I would have chosen engineering, because engineering in a way, you know, is an opportunity to solve problems. I think to me, an engineer is somebody who is always, you know, looking at providing optimal and sustainable solutions to the problems around that you see around us. So that is what is engineering. To me, engineering, you know, defining it as electrical, electronics, you know, mechanical, civil, that is all, you know, not necessary. Engineering should be to solve problems, and engineers are, I think of engineers as gods. I think we create things which don't exist otherwise. So that way, electron devices is a good area, because, you know, once you understand a device, everywhere you want to make a system, you will always find a device. And most of my work has also spanned across devices to circuits. You know, much of the work that I have done, always I picked up some of these devices which are in a very early stage, whether before FinFETs became mainstream technology or before any of these technologies became, you know, mainstream. I picked up those devices and then I started to build circuits around them and then optimize the devices from a circuit point of view, which is something not many people do, because, you know, when you are optimizing the device. But the moment you put that device into a circuit, depending on what the circuit functionality is, the device is not always at its best. And so these were the kind of concepts that I picked up. So I have always focused on systems. So in fact, even my IEEE fellow was also because of the recognition was also for my system on chip kind of integrations. And so that was important for me. But devices are the backbone of anything that you do. You know, even in sensors, at the end of the day, we use the same devices. The materials may be different, but the structures are all still FET-like. And for example, one of my very interesting sensor device was on a cantilever. We integrated an organic transistor. So we called it a cantifet. And whenever this cantilever sees any surface stress, the surface stress, in a way strains the channel in the transistor, and that gives rise to changes in the performance. As we all know, the mobility is a function of the stress and strain that you have in the channel. And so these were the concepts that I used for sensors as well. And that, some of these papers became, you know, pretty well cited and used now in applications and all of that. So everything starts with devices. And I think I would always like to be an engineer, and an engineer who provides solutions to the real world problems, but without forgetting the science. You know, I think the science is the one where, you know, that's a backbone for everything. If there is no science, there is actually no technology, and the science part of it should continue, but from that science should emerge the technology, and technology should lead to solutions to the problems that you see around us in the society. So I think it has to be a seamless kind of a connect, you know, scientists working in silos, engineers, again, defining themselves as electronics, electrical, mechanical, civil, and then, you know, the circuit people not talking to the devices people. I think with that kind of an approach, we will never be able to optimize anything. So it has to be a seamless integration of science to technology to solutions. And that is what I have always believed in. In fact, for many of my work in the sensors, I had, you know, very highly multidisciplinary kind of activities, and there were at least 6 or 7 departments involved in building some of the systems which are now commercially available. And so that approach, I believe, is important. So,
no, I fully agree with you. I think, like, you know, that this territorialism, working in my own comfort zone, and I don't share, and I don't need to know about anything. That hurts. Technologically, that definitely hurts, because when we look at all the successful companies, especially in hardware business is very difficult to build, because it requires a lot of different kind of expertise, and to bring them into a sync is a challenging task. And that when we focus just on the device, then it is kind of just as an example, that we can use a very highly scaled device like a nanowire, but when we go and put them in a circuitry, the question is that whether one single nanowire can produce sufficient current to execute a logic transition or not. The answer most probably is going to be no. And it means that we have to club them together, which means that what is then the scaling aspect of it, right? So I think these are the things that, you know, that becomes imminent when we start going beyond what we are doing. It's good to be like, you know, I concur with what you just said, that to be grounded on science, to build my own expertise in whatever is my area, and then to reach out to make the real connection, right? I think that that's a closed loop feedback system for expansion. Okay. Thanks for sharing that. Okay, I am going to ask you a question. It's kind of like, you know, that we say Eureka moment. Now, know that you are an accomplished and device engineer, like, you know, the system circuits expansion with those kind of things. And at the same time, as an academic leadership, you have transformed one of the world's most probably the rigorous institutions for engineering, IITs. And so you can pick whatever, like, you know, your choice. That tell us about one of those, like, you know, that your leadership aspiration. What was your Eureka moment that, okay, so these are the things that I need to do, we need to do, and how you actually made this transformation. And I, honestly speaking, I do not have that kind of opportunity always. And, you know, that that's one of the reasons that, like, you know, that we will be really benefited, our audience, hearing from you. Please go ahead.
No, institutions are also like individuals. We can be siloed, you know, pretty easily if we don't make an effort to connect with the society around us. That is also something that has happened with Indian institutions. The biggest challenge with Indian academia, the higher education, is, you know, very fragmented higher education system. For whatever reason it is, since the time we got independence, 1947, and since 1950s and 60s, we have been creating these higher educational institutions. You know, we have, for if you want to do engineering, you come to IITs, the Indian Institutes of Technology. And then if you want to do management, you go to Indian Institutes of Management, and they have no relation to IITs. They work in their own silo. You want to do medicine, you go to All India Institutes of Medical Sciences. These are hospitals, nothing to do with engineering. You won't even find an engineer, you know, among those doctors. And you want to do, for example, science, you go to ISES. We have Indian Institutes of Science Education and Research, which are entirely focused on sciences and without any regard to, you know, engineering category. So that I can, there are multiple such institutions. Now for pharmacy, we have separate institutions. For agriculture, we have separate institutions. That has become a biggest challenge in this country now, because we have siloed this education, the fragmented way we are doing things. And unfortunately, even the funding agencies are also fragmented. You want to do research in bio, you cannot go to one agency, you have to go to another agency. They will only fund the bio researchers. As an engineer, if I go there, they will throw me out saying that you don't know enough bio and all of that. So that is the biggest challenge in this country. And now we are trying to integrate. So even at IIT Delhi, you know, which is the institution that I headed for 6 years. And, you know, even here, the problem was a great institution, but then, you know, people are not connecting with each other. Everyone is doing well, but doing in their own narrow kind of an area. And just outside IIT in Delhi alone, there are like 40 institutions, you know, and 40 very good institutions, but nobody is talking to each other. Everyone is working in their own kind of spheres. And that is what I particularly wanted to change. And I always believed that, you know, we have been preaching in this country, you know, starting with the first convocation of IIT Delhi, you know, you keep hearing academia should connect with industry. I know these things, academia industry relations should improve. All of that we have been saying for a very, very long time. But I always, you know, believed as an academic administrator for the past 6 years, I believed that we need to put money where our mouth is. You know, if we are saying something, you know, we have to initiate kind of schemes through which you can support or encourage people to do certain things. And then, you know, once you have a scheme, you can also measure. As an engineer, you know, one thing we do is if I cannot measure something, there is no engineering, you know. If only if I can measure, I can optimize, I can improve, I can do, you know, further things. So for me, I started schemes. For example, one of the schemes I said was, you know, I started a scheme called Faculty Interdisciplinary Research Program, FIRP, as we call it. And I said, if any faculty member in any department wants to collaborate with another faculty member who has a very diverse expertise and then writes a proposal which looks coherent, which will be, of course, reviewed by a panel of experts, then institute will give them a seed grant. That seed grant is sufficient for them to hire a person and work for a couple of years together with that faculty member. So we also put the condition that it should be for the first time, that if you are already collaborating, then there is no need for this. You know, you are already into the game. But if you are not, then, you know, for the first time, if you want to collaborate with someone, institute provides a seed grant. And institute, you know, also doesn't have infinite resources. We said, but after 2 years of working together, you need to go out and apply for research grants outside and get extramural kind of grant. So we started a scheme and we started funding research. I can tell you there was an explosion of interest. The moment we said you get some amount of money, as researchers, we are always looking for money. And here they felt, you know, there is money available, however small it is. And then we saw that everybody wanting to connect with everybody. And there was, you know, complete integration of different disciplines and excellent proposals. And that was a huge success. And that increased our research budgets. Subsequently, the extra grants that extramural grants that we received also went up by, you know, almost like 4 times in a matter of a few years, because now people are interacting with each other and, you know, getting funds from outside. Whatever we invested, that came back, you know, 10 times that money has actually come back out of that research. And the same thing we extended to other institutions. We said that, you know, whoever wants to collaborate with, let us say, All India Institute of Medical Sciences, and IIT will fund our faculty. I had an arrangement with AIIMS director, the president of AIIMS, saying that you fund your faculty under the same scheme, I fund my faculty. Then these two institutions started working together. And then immediately we saw almost like 50 projects coming together and you know, the research happening. And now we created a kind of a Delhi cluster, and that involves all the 40 institutions now. And now government also started a new scheme. In the last budget, they announced a glue grant for these institutions to come together. And that is how, you know, something we started on a small scale, just to connect our faculty from across the departments, now has become a national initiative. Now they have formed 5 such clusters in the country, in large cities, connecting all these institutions. So that was a big success. And another thing which I always believed was, in India, if you notice, there are a lot of startups now. You know, India is a startup country. We have something like, you know, 40, almost like 60 startups now, which are unicorns, you know, the unicorn status. And all of them, every week, there is a new unicorn getting formed now. That is how fast things are growing. But one thing you notice is all these unicorns are in e-commerce space. And they're all, you know, this aggregator kind of a model. And but none in the technology area, none in the deep technology kind of a space. And that is something that worries me, because, you know, e-commerce and all that is good, but they are all, you know, they manage the wealth. Somebody has to create wealth through technology. But who will create that wealth? You know, this has to be, you know, people who have expertise in certain areas, who have studied, you know, longer than just doing a bachelor's and starting companies. And so I started a scheme. I wanted to convert the faculty members in our institution into entrepreneurs, because these people have been working for a long period of time. And if they start companies, if we can promote that culture, if faculty members are doing it, the PhD students will also do the same. And that is how the deep tech entrepreneurship, you know, will thrive. That was my idea again. But for that again, you know, I thought you can give speeches telling people to do that. But then, no, if there are no incentives for someone to do that, it won't happen. So I started a scheme called FIRE, F-I-R-E, that stands for Faculty Innovation and Research-Driven Entrepreneurship. And I said, if any faculty member wants to start a company, institute gives them a sabbatical. Until now, sabbatical is usually taken to go abroad, you know, to teach at another university. But we said, even for startup, you can take sabbatical now. And you can also take additional leave if required. And the institute also gives a grant to these people to build a prototype for their company. And then we provided multiple other, I mean, you know, incentives for them to become entrepreneurs. Once we started that scheme, you know, a lot of people started applying. And in some departments now, every fifth faculty member has a startup of his or her own. And some of these are now becoming successful startups. They're also getting high valuations. I think that was again through a scheme. So as an administrator, I realized that just preaching things to academics, you know, we only hear and forget. But if you incentivize that through some grants, you know, seed funding and all that, then it triggers a sort of a, you know, a huge, you know, what do I call it, rush into, you know, doing those things. And that is how things develop. And that is how, you know, we can see, you know, a lot of these things happening right now. So I think some of these schemes that we did, you know, we did many other things for students too. And even students also, you know, the problem is every student starts a project, right? And then graduates and the project is lying there. The next student comes, starts another project, and again, it reaches a certain stage and it lies there. And that is how, you know, we have become a museum of all these boxes, you know, nice aluminum boxes, you know, which are all trying to do something, but all half done kind of a thing. So we started a relay project scheme. Now we said, we started a scheme where in every such project, there will be students from four different years, first year, second year, third year, fourth year. So every team must have students from all the different batches. And then when the final year student graduates, the one first year student comes in. So that way these projects will never end. You know, these projects are also funded by the institute, and then these projects never end. They continue to progress. And then many of them, which we started, we call them actually discover and learn 1-2-3-4 program. The 1-2-3-4 there stands for first year, second year, third year, and fourth year students coming together. These are the very bright students that we get in IITs, and they working together and working in a relay kind of a fashion. Many of these are now becoming startups. And that is also one thing which has become pretty successful at IIT Delhi. So some of these schemes I'm pretty, you know, happy about the way they have shaped up and the way, you know, they have become successful.
You know that in such a short time, you shared so many valuable perspectives, right? Like, you know, that starting from one of the things, you know, when we talk about social media, when we talk about social engineering, when we talk about Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, like, you know, they're all these e-commerce aspects. If we did not have a good hardware in our hand, it would not have been possible. So I always say that, and even when we look at, like, you know, the touchscreen iPhone, that kind of revolutionized the way that we interact with our society, with each of us. You know, that before that, when we used to go to the like, you know, the airports to get our boarding passes or tickets. So we press, like, on the screen back in 2001, the first time I went to USA, and then I went to the grocery store swiping, like, you know, I saw one of my seniors, he was swiping his credit card and then signing in their touchscreen. Touchscreen was there. But what was the idea of bringing that in, like, you know, from that resistive, like, you know, sensing to capacitive sensing and to make it so smooth, right? That's the technological part. So I think, like, you know, that you are absolutely right that, like, you know, with the rise of these, maybe everyone doesn't need to actually launch a startup. Some people need to really work deeply on make things working, right? Like, you know, that. But at the same time, like, you know, that I was about to ask you this question, but you already responded that we see that there is an encouragement to the faculty to be involved in startups, but at the same time, the faculty have a lot of different responsibilities, including depending on the size that they are maintaining in their about their research group, that these students, postdoc researchers, they need to have their sustenance, like, you know, and the faculty have to vouch for that. So you made it easy because you gave them sabbatical, like, you know, so there are incentivization is very important to inspire, like, you know, that. And not only the inspiration, sometimes there is inspiration, but there is no logical route to, you know, try for that. And I think, like, you know, there's so many fantastic ideas, this discover and learn 1-2-3-4 is just like, you know, the relay race, right? Like, that if Usain Bolt is gone, there will be someone, but he passed the torch, right? Like, you know, it's fantastic to think that from that perspective. So in that regard, I want to ask you, you have taken so many initiatives. Will you, like, you know, I know this is very hard, but can you pick one which, like, you know, the made, which gave you the satisfaction of some accomplishment that, yes, like, you know, that this is I wanted to do and this has happened, like, you know, that, that one, just pick one if possible.
Yeah, as a researcher, if you ask me, you know, I have always wanted to see things that I do, you know, reach people, you know, finally the end users. So I am proud that, you know, at least the projects that I started, I initiated, now are products which are available in the country for anyone to buy and which are also getting exported. Now, one of them is the explosive detector. We launched a nano sniffer and, you know, which is the low, very, it is a micro sensor based system. No spectroscopy, no reactions between molecules and all that. It works on a physical principle, and it can detect all kinds of explosives and pretty low cost in terms of maintenance as well. And now that's the big technology. It's a disruptive technology. We hold US patent for that. But it has again happened. I initiated the project, it is again like a relay race. You know, somebody took it forward. Then we incubated a company, NanoSniff. And finally, NanoSniff worked hard on that. Investors came in and gave money. And now it is a product. So that, as a researcher, that is very satisfying to me, that something which I initiated now is a product, and hopefully it will save lives one day. And that's the thing. And as an academic administrator, in my role as the director of IIT Delhi, there were many initiatives that we started. But one thing is, you know, IITs have, you know, for example, the alumni, you know, we have a huge alumni base, like 55,000 alumni. And but that giving back culture doesn't exist in our country. And one thing is, in India, you know, these are all government funded institutions, and because these are government funded institutions, alumni think that we have lots of money, you know, anyway government is funding, and they never thought it's required for them to, you know, pay back. And education is free in India. You know, we hardly charge any money from anyone. The fee that we charge, you know, is pretty minimal. And there are, again, so many incentives we give based on their income and other things, that, you know, hardly, only about 40% of people pay a little bit of money. The remaining 60%, you know, don't really pay any fee and all that. So we said, you know, how do you run the institutions? And government cannot keep on supporting institutions forever. There were 5 IITs. Now we have 23 IITs. And, you know, as a result, the government funding is also coming down. So there was a kind of a crisis situation. That is when I approached alumni of IIT Delhi, and we launched what was known as the country's first endowment fund, the endowment fund initiative. And I touched base with the Honorable President of India, the President Rashtrapati. And we spoke with the President's office. We said that, any alumnus who gives $1 million, you know, around $1 million, we will invite them for a cup of tea with President of India. And that was a deal that we had. So any alumnus who signs up saying that, you know, I will give this money of $1 million, you know, then they get invited to Rashtrapati Bhavan and we will have an event. And that day, you know, when after we announced it, that endowment fund and this kind of a scheme, $1 million to have chai with President of India, on that night, we received commitments of something like $30 million, you know, on that one night. You know, we had $30 million kind of commitments from alumni, and all that money now is flowing in. And we launched that formal endowment fund, and many more alumni started giving money. The last one we received before I stepped down as a director was a $10 million donation by one of our distinguished alumnus and alumni. And so he has given it for the School of AI. And, you know, that now has opened up an avenue for alumni to connect with the institute and also give back, you know, to the institute. And that is taking off now. And we set a target of $1 billion by 2030. So that's our target. And by 2025, we should reach almost like, you know, $200 million kind of a endowment fund. And that is now progressing well. And we have a formal structure, and alumni now are assured that their money will be properly utilized. And that has been a turning point. And after we did that, now Government of India has prepared a template based on what we did. Now all institutions in the country are asked to follow a similar kind of a model. So now it has gone on to many other institutions now. And so there is a kind of a transformation that is happening. In fact, I'm also proud of the fact that even President of India, after launching the endowment fund, he also felt that he should give back to his alma mater some money, which he had also not done before, because that culture was not existent. And he gave back, you know, some money to his alma mater in Kanpur, you know, because he asked other people to do that at IIT Delhi. So that was a kind of a thing, you know, that actually happens.
Yeah, so many good ideas and fantastic. You know, we are connected via LinkedIn and I see your posts. So I'm aware of some of those like contributions made by the IIT alumni. And like, you know, that nowadays you will hear a lot of things about the Indian soft power, right? That many of the Fortune 50 or the Forbes 100 companies, the CEOs or in the executive levels, they are dominated by the, you know, the alumni of India, the IITs, right? Like, you know, so that's great. I want to actually like, you know, bring a question that's from my side. Because you have taken so many initiatives, including like, you know, the growth and so on and so forth. So like, you know, I'm sure that you have taken also initiatives on promoting the diversity, equity and inclusion. Can you please share some of your experience and success stories and perspectives?
No, one thing which I was also very keen was to encourage more women participation in IIT Delhi. In fact, the first dean, you know, a woman as a dean happened during my time. And until that time, in the 60-year history of IIT Delhi, there was never a dean who was a woman. And there was never a woman who became a dean. So that was a kind of a, you know, thing that happened. And we also created IGES, as we call it, Institute Gender Sensitization Committee. And then a few people who are aligned with that vision. And we made it now mandatory for any faculty member, any staff member, every student who is joining to go through a mandatory course and then answer certain questions. And only when they are, when they correctly answer, then they are inducted into the faculty or staff or, you know, whatever it is. So that we made it now as part of our process. And we also wanted to have more women join engineering in IIT. So every year we conduct counseling sessions for women who qualify in the entrance examination. What happens in India is, you know, many parents still don't want to send their children, you know, to faraway places, and they want to, you know, a girl student who has qualified in the JEE advanced exam could have got admission in some IIT. But, you know, but they don't want to send them far away. So they admit that child in a local college, though it's not an IIT, because, you know, the girl will be nearby and that kind of a thing. So that is a culture that exists in India. So we wanted to change that. So we also, you know, started speaking with the parents, assuring them the safety and assuring them that coming to Delhi, coming to the campus is as good as, you know, staying at home. It is that much secure, and it's also, you know, we provide all these facilities for the child and all that. So we did all of that, and that has started to make a difference. And now at IIT Delhi, you know, every third student is a woman, so which is one change that has happened now. At the undergraduate level, it is touching 20% now. It's about 17% at the undergraduate level. But overall, in the PhD programs and other programs, if you take it together, one third of students are now girls. So which is a major transformation, I would think. And among faculty also, we started to promote the diversity, particularly the gender diversity. And for that, you know, we have special drives to recruit women faculty. And that also something which we did. We did for the first time when I was a director. And so some of these initiatives are beginning to help us, because in engineering kind of disciplines, you need, you know, that diversity is very important. Not only gender diversity, but diversity of all types, you know, which is very important. And fortunately in India, you know, the other sorts of social kind of things are happening through reservations and all that. We have, you know, the reservation policies, which always ensure that you have people from different social backgrounds, you know, coming to IIT. So that has been there But for girls, we did not have any special kind of schemes. And so now those schemes are also getting created. So I think we are becoming better in terms of diversity. But despite all that, you know, in IITs never had a woman as a director until now. And 23 IITs, you know, almost 70 years of history of creating these IITs, we haven't had a woman as a director, which is not good, but that's not in my hands, unfortunately. It is, these appointments are made by the government of India. So, but there is pressure now on everyone. In the last 5 years, you know, there has been a tremendous progress on gender diversity issues. Everybody is becoming aware now. Now, today, you know, if you form a panel, if there is no woman on the panel, you know, I think you will immediately have a backlash thanks to social media and other places. So I think now that awareness has come, and which is good for the country. So I hope in the near future, we will also have a woman director. But we had our first woman dean at IIT Delhi recently.
No, I think I agree with you. Like, pretty much in most of the places in the world, like, you know, where there was discrimination, and it's still there is, but like, you know, the people, especially the generation, you know, the Z and, like, you know, the millennials, they're very much concerned about this, and they take steps, and we are seeing progress. Obviously, you know, that it's always a process of perfecting. So I think, like, you know, this momentum will continue. So we'll be switching now to a little bit lighthearted portion of our conversation. And this is very popular with the younger audience. And it is, we call, like, the rapid fire round. You know, we prefer that you answer with one word, but obviously, you know, we are not going to restrict you, right? Like, you know, they're spilling all the beans. So whenever you're ready, I'll go ahead and we'll start that rapid fire round.
Sure.
Okay. What are your hobbies?
My hobbies are mostly reading, and I like outdoor sports. Every day in the evening, I go out and play. I also like traveling. So now I'm actually on a travel in a hotel room here. So I do that. Yeah.
Okay. Music or movie? Which one you enjoy more?
Movies, for sure. I at least watch one movie every 2 weeks or so.
Okay. Which is your favorite genre of movie?
Hindi, mostly Hindi. English once in a while, but Hindi movies I connect very well. So.
Okay. Yeah, Bollywood is big. Okay. What is the book you are reading now?
Oh, right now I am reading a book by the title Born a Muslim by Ghazala Wahab, which is a book that came out recently about Indian Muslims and how things are changing for them and all that. And before that, I was reading this Connecting the Dots, you know, Lessons for Leadership in a Startup World by John T. Chambers, the Cisco president, who was a Cisco president for a long time. So I keep reading at least one book, you know, is always in my bag. I keep reading.
Right. It's a fantastic habit. What is your favorite cuisine?
South Indian. South Indian cuisine. Wherever I go, I can do with that. So.
Okay. You said that you enjoy outdoor sports. So which one you enjoy the most?
Of course, cricket. As a student, I played cricket. I was good at it. I mean, I couldn't have competed at any level, but I was good, whichever team I was. So cricket still.
What's your position? Like, you know, the batsman, bowler, all-rounder, wicketkeeper?
I'm an all-rounder. So
okay. That we know from the life. Okay. You said that you love traveling. So what is your favorite travel spot?
New York still. New York happens to be my favorite place. So whenever I am in the US, I make it a point to stop by in New York and, you know, go to Times Square and all that. So I like that place for some reason.
Yeah. It is so animated. who cannot love, like, you know, the New York City? Okay, we are coming back to like, you know, the more on this part, which is the last portion of our conversation. It's been a fantastic conversation with you. And this is going to be more on looking at the future. So my first question regarding this is, what is your thought about electronics in the future?
Yeah, the electronics, will be, in my opinion, more integrated kind of an approach. And it will also be needs to become more sustainable. I think, you know, we have a lot to learn from the nature. You know, if you look at nature, nature doesn't create any waste. The waste created by one process becomes input for the other process. So that is how nature has this circular kind of an economy. And as engineers, as technologists, we are stuck with this linear kind of a thing where you produce waste everywhere. Now, I think that cannot continue forever. So I would like to see more sustainable kind of technologies, you know, which don't harm the planet as we have more and more technologies in the pockets. I think that's one thing that I would think needs to happen. And I particularly believe in a country like India, the IoT will be the future. You know, I think there will be tons of sensors. I mean, that trillion sensor kind of a vision is what I will see, improving quality of life in the country. I hardly see, for example, agriculture, if you take, there is agriculture in India is a losing profession. I know about 60% of Indians are still in the agriculture kind of a business or domain, and its contribution to economy is only, our GDP is only 14% or 15%, which is further declining. And that is happening because we haven't seen any new technologies in agriculture and IoT kind of a thing. You know, somebody going with a small, techno device and then doing the soil health monitoring, advising the farmers, what the soil actually needs, kind of a thing. So those sort of technologies are what are required. I have a startup, Soil Sense, which is focusing on that. But again, when I look at electronics is not just, mobile phones and laptops and desktops. Electronics which can improve quality of life, for a farmer, makes the farming profitable, and electronics which saves lives. For example, whether you are traveling in a bus or a train in India, there is nothing protecting you. The technologies are not there. I think these places need to be secured. You can have simple IoT kind of devices which are monitoring the presence of some of these materials in the buses and trains, and then protecting the people while without being intrusive. These are all hidden under the seats and where the bags are kept, and like the sniffer dogs, the sniffing electronic nose kind of platforms. So those sort of things are required right now, and the future of electronics is to make our life secure and is to improve the quality of life, and without being intrusive in nature. When you enter an airport, in India, everywhere, at every 100 steps now, you have somebody coming and checking you. I think that cannot be the future. I think it has to be a seamless integration into our lives, and we shouldn't even be, stopped somewhere, for checking anything. That's what electronics needs to become.
Yeah, that this is something very interesting observation. I always keep saying that, in many of the airports, so your passport is being checked or your identity card, and then you go inside, and then there are five more times it's being checked. So every time I'm actually discrediting my colleague who did it for the first time, right? And there's no way that these devices, these are I cannot get out of it right away. But I think it's a very interesting observation. There is something I can see that you try to figure out the technological solution from the challenges that we have in our daily life. So is there anything that strikes your mind which could be better today, but it is not?
I think the charging, every day you get up and you are charging your wallet to a phone, to a computer, to everything. I think that has to go away. And I would like to see in the next 5 years, the wireless charging from a distance, becoming a reality, that your devices are always charged, that I don't have to, take out my wire and plug it in. I consider it, archaic. I think time has come to get rid of all these cables and for charging purposes.
Right.
But you know, at the same time, like, you know, the battery technology, right? Like, and so I have seen that the Indian, like, you know, the billionaires, they're investing quite a bit in the battery technology. I think, like, you know, that if we can get out of this volumetric, like, you know, the tyranny, I think we will do really better. Okay. You have all sort of fantastic ideas. One application you would like to see in the future that does not exist today?
In fact, I am now talking to some corporates. I want to, you know, do what I call a biodome in India. What this biodome basically will do is there are lots of diagnostic technologies for healthcare applications, you know, which are non-invasive. You know, today you can monitor, you know, practically almost every body parameter without having to poke something, you know, into the skin and all that. And those technologies, you know, is what I want to integrate them. But there are many startups, you know, selling their own particular kind of a gadget for a particular application. So I want to, you know, bring all of them together and build a kind of a dome that will integrate all these technologies. Now, for example, in rural areas today in India, the healthcare infrastructure is almost non-existent. You know, even in a place like Delhi, right, if you go away, you know, 10 kilometers from the center of the town or 20 kilometers, you know, you don't have anything. You know, if somebody has a heart problem or something, you have to rush to, you know, all these big hospitals in the cities and all that. In India, you know, I read a report somewhere, 22 million people every year go below the poverty line because of healthcare expenditure. And why it happens? Because in a remote place, in a remote town, somebody falls ill. In the family, the entire family comes to a big city, you know, for their medical treatment. And in the process, you know, they go below the poverty line. And that is happening for 22 million people in this country. I think that is avoidable completely. And you know, if you can have in the villages, and our doctors don't want to go to those rural places because they also have families, the education, all of those avenues are available only in cities. So everybody wants to come to the cities now. So whereas, you know, but there are people still, you know, who are living in those rural areas, a biodome where somebody enters and sits in a chair. And then, you know, you monitor all the body parameters, and these parameters are now seen by somebody in a city or town, a doctor, and then, you know, screen the people, and whoever needs a medical attention, you know, they can be provided that medical attention, and that way you can save lives. And for example, there are so many people in this country living without knowing that they have diabetes. You know, because they don't know they have diabetes, they live a normal, they eat normal kind of things and live a normal, whatever is their lifestyle. But, you know, they develop all these symptoms because of diabetes and they are just getting treated for those symptoms. And many people lose their lives, you know, because of the diabetes kind of thing. We are a diabetes capital of the world. And some of these, if they are detected early, you know, you can save lives. And today there are those technologies available. So I want to create a biodome kind of a thing and place them, you know, have them in the country and connect them with the kind of infrastructure that we have, IT infrastructure, with the cities and hospitals, and then ensure that people are screened more regularly. And many of these diseases, you know, you try to prevent, and who require medical attention, you know, provide them that medical attention. So these are the kinds of technologies, you know, that's one project which I'm actually talking to corporates and see how we can take it forward. So that's something which I want to create right now.
Well, I think it's a great, grand vision because as of today, in many countries, majority of the population, they live in the rural areas. And, you know, everyone needs to have equal access, especially the people who might not be doing, like, you know, well off. They need far more attention than anybody else. And when we talk about upward mobility and, like, you know, all those kind of things, it is not about just a fragmented, urbanized, highly educated people living in a la-la land, but it is about the others, right? Like, you know, that who is just not going to take a flight to Dubai or somewhere else, but the people, like, you know, they're everywhere. I think, like, you know, the having the infrastructure of, like, you know, the monitoring and, like, powered and enabled by AI, it's going to actually create an ecosystem which is going to not only lessen the human suffering, it's also will reduce the burden of the overall finance of any nation. because you know, the healthcare is an expensive venture. It is something we cannot we will never be able to immortalize ourselves, but we can definitely enhance the quality of our life. I fully agree with you. Okay, so this is our last formal question for you, and a piece of suggestion for the young generation.
I think the young generation, I always believed in these three P's, the passion. I think getting into areas which you feel passionate about, I think that is how it should be. The patience, I interact with many young people. They are restless. They just want all this quick fix kind of solutions, the instant gratification for anything that they do. I think the world doesn't work that way. I think I keep telling them, keep patience. You have done good, but then, you have to wait for the results to come. And for example, even youngsters pursuing higher studies. Now in India, our biggest challenge is less than 5% of our graduates in a place like IIT Delhi, Bombay, are going for higher education because they think, you do this BTEC and then you do an MBA and then you are done. And so that kind of a thing. And so that patience is important. And finally, the perseverance. I think every time you face a problem, you give up. And that way, you can never really achieve anything. So I always tell people the passion, patience, and perseverance. I think that has helped me in my life. One thing which I have followed always is whatever you do, I think do it the best way possible. I think there is never a half-hearted kind of an attempt. You give your 100% to anything you do. It doesn't matter, whether you are teaching, whether you are doing research, whether you are, doing administration, anything you do, you give your 100%. And that I have, always followed in my life. And if I cannot do that, I don't also take up that responsibility. And I think that is important. And I would like to see the very bright people, and my biggest, regret is that they are not living up to their full potential. The graduate, the students who come to IIT Delhi kind of a place to pursue studies, these are the brightest of the lot. But I don't see them, performing well or performing to the level of their ability in their lives, saturating very early and finding a job and settling down too early. You never hear about them. And some of these guys, students, if they can go up, aspire for bigger things, I think, India would have been a better place and the world also would have been a better place. I think I would like to see them aiming high, not saturate very early, because I think they are bestowed with all these abilities and which are very unique, very rare, but they don't live up to those abilities, and which is a loss for the country and loss for the world. I hope to see many of them living up to their full potential.
And before I end up, I conclude, was there anything that I didn't ask you, but you wanted to share with us?
No, I think we have pretty much covered everything. Thank you very much. It was such a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for attending this IEEE EDS-sponsored podcast. To listen to other EDS podcasts, as well as benefits and resources EDS offers, please go to the website eds.ieee.org. Thank you for listening.